Now, the reason that I'm sharing this with you is in the last two decades in my journey, my search to understand who we are and how we relate to the forces of this world, and referencing the wisdom and the knowledge of those who have come before us to lay the foundation for those kinds of understandings, something very interesting has happened to me. What I've found is that on the temple walls in Egypt, in Bolivia, in some respects Peru, in the ancient texts, the time-worn texts of the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Coptic libraries in Egypt, indigenous, the oral traditions that have been passed down for hundreds of years, generation to generation, they've always referenced a mode of prayer that simply does not fit into any of these four categories. It is none of them. While it may have elements of maybe one or another, it does not fit into those categories. And to describe this mode of prayer, what I'd like to do is share with you a story. And I think perhaps by sharing the story will, again, lay the foundation that we can draw from to begin describing what now is recognized as a lost modality, or the fifth mode of prayer. It was in the early 1990s in the American Desert Southwest. I was spending a lot of time in the Southwest exploring in the pueblos, in the ancient archaeological sites, Chaco Canyon, New Mexico, for example, Bandelier National Park, the traditions of those who have come before us in our own backyard. It's so interesting to me that so many people believe we've got to go halfway around the world to find some of the most amazing sites that this planet has to offer. And the reality is that in our own backyard in North America, we have massive, massive, intricate sites that were constructed by ancient peoples a long, long time ago. And one of the reasons it's so interesting to me is because anywhere else in the world you go, and you see archaeological sites on the scale that we see here in North America, such as Chaco Canyon, they are called temples, temple sites. Here in our country, and we see something like this, and if it's not of this time, they're called old Indian ruins. Old Indian ruins. And there's a thinking that goes with that, and I find that very interesting. It was in my exploration of the ancient temple sites here in North America that I met a man who became a good friend of mine. And it is through my relationship with this friend that I can share with you what this lost modality of prayer is like and specifically how it works. So in the American Desert Southwest in the early 90s, there was a time of tremendous drought. The rains had not come for almost 5 years, and it was one of the driest periods that any of the elders could remember. The land was so dry that the Rio Grande River that actually begins in southern Colorado had all but dried up through southern Colorado into northern New Mexico. It actually began near the village of Cuesta, New Mexico, with the confluence of the Red River. That is where the Rio Grande actually began. I had a phone call from my friend one day, and I'll call him David, just to honor his privacy. And he said, "Greg, would you like to join me tomorrow morning when I go to a place in this world where my ancestors have gone for so long, no one can even remember why they began going here in the first place. It's a place," he said, "where the skins between the world become very thin. And in that place, it becomes very easy for a man or a woman in this world to communicate with other worlds." And he says, "Would you like to join me as we go to this place and pray rain for the crops and for the villages in this part of the world?" And he didn't have to ask me twice. I said, certainly, I would be honored and I would love to go. And I did. I met him the next morning. We found ourselves early in the morning, and this was in the summer months, hiking through waist-high fields of the beautiful, very fragrant high mountain sage that you find in the arid deserts in northern New Mexico. It's so fascinating that as we walked through the sage, each time our legs would brush against the tender tips of the sage, they release this fragrance, and all of a sudden, everywhere we go, we smell the fragrance of fresh sage, and it's just a beautiful experience. And we found ourselves in a field, approximately 135,000 acres of this beautiful sage, and I was simply following my friend David. I had no idea where we were going. And suddenly he looked and he says, "Well, there it is." And I looked, and I wasn't sure what I was looking at. And he says, "It's right there." And as I looked across the sage, I could just barely make out a place where the landscape looked a little different, that the tops of the sage were a little uneven, and we followed a path that led over to that place, and there in front of us was a very ancient structure on the ground, essentially an ancient medicine wheel that had been placed there a long, long time ago. And I asked David, I said, who put this here? And he said, this wheel has been here for so long, our ancestors don't even know who placed these stones here. And when I heard him say that, I remember I was just in awe, because I realized that the stones that I was looking at on the ground were precisely where the hands of another individual had placed them generations and generations ago. And David said, this is the place where the skins between the worlds are very thin, and this is the place where I'll pray rain. Well, I'll share with you right now that I was not prepared for what I saw. I had an expectation of what I thought was going to happen. I believed that I was going to see some chanting, at the very least, some dancing. And what I saw took me by surprise. David removed his shoes. He stepped into the wheel. And the first thing he did was he honored all of his ancestors. He said, all of my ancestors who have come before me, all of my ancestors. Then he honored the four directions, the four elements. He turned his back to me, held his hands in a prayer position, raised his face into the sun. And in just a couple of moments, he turned around, he looked at me, and he looked at his watch, and he said, I'm hungry. Should we go get a bite to eat? And I looked at him, and I said, I thought we came here so that you could pray for rain. And this is where the crux of this story is really key. Because he looked at me, he looked right into my eyes, and he said, no, we did not come here to pray for rain. He said, because if we prayed for rain, the rain could never happen. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? He said, in the traditions of our people, when you ask for something to happen, what you're doing is acknowledging to the Creator, to the Great Spirit, that it is not so, that it has not yet happened. So if I came and asked for rain, I would be saying, in effect, that there is no rain, and actually reinforcing the very condition that we came here to change. And I said, I understand that. When I saw you turn your back to me and you close your eyes, then can you share with me what happened inside of you? I asked him precisely the same question that I've asked the Tibetans, that I've asked in the nunneries and the monasteries, that I've asked in the Egyptian monks and the Peruvian shaman,